Okay, well, why does the dialectic matter? Well, I'm not going to go through what these debates are, but to give you an idea, there's been major debates where the dialectic has come up as an important issue a number of times in the revolutionary movement. After the 1905 defeat in Russia, there was a retreat into idealism by the intellectuals of the Bolsheviks, and Lenin went back to read Hegel and to study philosophy and talk about the dialectic. Materialists were thrown by Einstein's theory of relativity, and it was only, you know, by a dialectical understanding that people could understand how his theory didn't negate a materialist understanding. Rosa Luxemburg appealed to the issues raised by the dialectic in her debates against Bernstein, who argued for the German Social Democratic Party to move to the right and become reformists. Trotsky invoked the dialectic in debates with Stalin in his opposition to the rise of Stalin, and later it was an issue in the Trotskyist organisations themselves. And I'd argue that any consistent challenge to postmodernism today needs an understanding of the dialectic. And actually, a lot of our political positions that new members quickly become acquainted with are based on a dialectical understanding of capitalism and what it would take to build socialism. This talk is based basically on the arguments of John Rees in a book called Algebra of Revolution. I forgot to bring one to show you what it's like, and we don't have any in stock at the moment. It's not that easy to get. But the reason it's based on this book is because John Rees has the politics of the International Socialists. He's and he has done a basically thorough summary and summing up of the classical revolutionary Marxism, the traditions and the contributions of the people who have contributed to that revolutionary tradition. So he goes through how Marx and Engels developed a materialist dialectic from the arguments of Hegel. Then he looks at Lenin, Trotsky, Rosa Luxemburg, Lukács's History and Class Consciousness, Antonio Gramsci from Italy, and to a lesser extent, Labriola. So what is the dialectic? Well, the dialectic involves three principles: totality, change, and contradiction. Now, separately, these are not dialectical, but we do need to, they need to be understood together, but we have to talk about them separately to come to grips with them. The totality of any phenomenon is made up not just of discrete elements all just added together, but of contradictory parts. And the parts exist in contradiction with each other, and they impact on each other in contradictory ways. And these contradictions drive constant change. Engels summed up the great advance that he regarded Hegel's dialectic, that he thought Hegel's dialectical understanding of history was. He said, "For the first time, the whole world, natural, historical, intellectual, is represented as a process, i.e. as in constant motion, change, transformation, development, and the attempt is made to trace out the internal connection that makes a continuous whole of all this movement and development." So what does all this mean? Well, it recognises that capitalism is a system racked by internal contradictions which have to be understood if we want to change it. And at the centre of capitalism, there's the conflict between the bourgeoisie and the proletariat. And neither of these classes can be understood outside their relationship to each other or outside the totality of the capitalist social relations. So, for instance, if you want to analyse the situation in Europe today and the crisis in Greece, it's not enough to just be excited that workers are beginning to fight back. I have been fighting back and for some time in Greece. How things will develop depend on how the ruling class, both of Greece and of other countries, respond to this fight back, how far they're prepared to go to the edge of the abyss and risk Greece plunging into deep depression in order to discipline the working class. So it's stripped to its bare essentials, it's a two-sided contest, and the actions of both sides will influence the final outcome. How savage is the ruling class prepared to be, and how will the working class organisations respond to this savagery? But then the ideas and organisation will play a role in the outcome as well. Another term of the dialectic is unity of opposites, which is just another way of saying that contradictory aspects can only be understood in their relationship to each other, but also that any situation or any phenomenon is made up of contradictory elements. So, for example, we take two key contradictions in the structure of the capitalist economy. The tendency for the rate of profit to decline because of the competitive struggle between the capitalists. In other words, economic crisis can only be understood as the result of the contradictory nature of economic growth and boom under capitalism. And so crisis and economic boom exist as a unity of opposites, not, as the Stalinists said, an identity of opposites. And in fact, Trotsky, I think, used an even more illuminating term. He talked about the differentiated unity of opposites. So by understanding the boom, capitalists investing more and more in the means of production in comparison with the source of their profits, i.e. labour power, living labour, you come to understand the crisis. Secondly, the competition sends some capitalists broke and the successful buy them up, creating a dynamic towards monopoly. So it seems like a logical contradiction that competition leads to monopoly, and it's one that the capitalists obviously don't really accept. But it's a dialectical contradiction, it's not a logical contradiction. Also, I'd argue that contrary to accusations by opponents of Marxism, the economic base and the superstructure do not exist in some mechanical relationship where everything can just be reduced to economics. They interact in contradictory ways. So in terms of the dialectic, the parts and the whole mutually condition or mediate each other. So I want to look at what we argue about the family as to give people some sense of how the dialectic is used. Because like all the parts of the phenomenon of capitalism, it does have its own dynamic and it can be analysed in its own terms. But to fully understand it and the role that it plays in the system, we have to firstly examine the history of why the capitalists turn to it as a way to reproduce the working class, how the oppression of women means that the relationships in the family, even if they're loving ones, are based on an unequal relationship between women and men. Because the oppression of women is conditioned by the relations of production, and this in turn mediates relations in the family. So if we compare this with the mechanical, which is actually a reductionist argument of the structuralists, where they argue that patriarchy exists as one structure, capitalism exists as another structure, and, you know, they may intersect at times, but there's no real explanation for when or why they might intersect. And so they conclude that men and women are unequal in a family, therefore women's oppression is caused by all men. Well, and I'd argue that rather than our experience being divided between private and public, which goes along with the patriarchy versus capitalism argument, as they conclude, which is, you know, from what I think is a truly mechanical theory, these different spheres of life exist in very contradictory and complex ways. For example, women enter the family on the basis of relationships grounded in exploitation. They have fewer career paths, they're more likely to be part-time and low-paid. On the other hand, the family mediates the experience in the paid workforce. You can think of the debates in society reflect this phenomenon, that the debate about the need of capitalism to have women in the paid workforce, some under pressure to work long hours, others with not enough hours, and the, you know, the cost of childcare, that it isn't provided properly for women, and all of this having women in the workforce somewhat contradicts the ideology of women as the mothers and, you know, look at the carers of the family. Also, the family has continually changed as capitalism has revolutionised the means of production. So I'd argue that the family plays both an economic and an ideological superstructural role, and it mediates the work experience of both women and men. In other words, the totality of capitalism and its constituent parts mediate and are mediated by the experience of the family. So mediation is the fourth term, a key term of the dialectic. So if we sum up so far with a sentence from John Rees, he says, "The general form of the dialectic is an internally contradictory totality in a constant process of change." And in the Marxist tradition, these terms, They're not just intellectual tools. They're not just an abstract set of laws that we impose on reality. They are real material processes, and that's why we talk of dialectical materialism. Because as Marx famously said, to overcome the idea of private property, the idea of communism is sufficient. In order to supersede private property as it actually exists, real communist activity is necessary. So let's turn to a few more fundamental questions. Any materialist view of the world needs to start with humanity and the natural world. A dialectical view rejects the humans as naked apes theories, but it equally opposes the idea that humans are some kind of alien influence in an otherwise pristine natural world, as some environmentalists argue. Humans are both part of the natural world and distinct from it, and their distinctness is the result of actual material processes by which an ape became human, and the material processes involve the way that humans act on the world around them, how they develop the ability for language and consciousness, which raises the question of the dialectics of nature, which we're not going to deal with other than to say that, well, there is a dialectics of nature, I think we can say, but it's different from the dialectics of society because the laws of nature are not mediated by conscious action. And so this view of humans raises a dialectical understanding of the relationship of consciousness and subjectivity and objective material reality, which is a huge debate in philosophy. Consciousness or ideas are not just a reflection of reality, but neither are they the reality and consciousness counterposed, as some people think. The thing that distinguishes humans from animals is that we labour, not that we're conscious. And as we produce our means of subsistence, we change the world, and in doing so, we change ourselves. And the new circumstances then give rise to new consciousness, and it's a continual process. And Marx grappled with this problem in the thesis on Feuerbach. In the third thesis, he posed a question. He said, the materialist doctrine concerning the changing of circumstances and upbringing forgets that the circumstances are changed by men, and that it is essential to educate the educator himself. I haven't changed the gender-specific language because it's ridiculous for us to impose our values on the time of people in the past. This is the way people wrote in the past. It's not just Marx. This doctrine must, therefore, divide society into two parts, one of which is superior to society. And his answer was, the coincidence of changing of circumstances and of human activity or self-change can be conceived and rationally understood only as revolutionary practice. Now, what does he mean by this? Not that the only thing that matters is that people are running around making revolution. What he's getting at is that humans find new ways of producing the things that they need, and this changes both the world around them and their consciousness. But there's nothing predetermined about this process because humans consciously intervene. And Marx summed up the process. He said, in considering social transformations, a distinction should always be made between the material transformation of the material conditions of production, which can be determined with the precision of natural science and the legal, political, religious, aesthetic or philosophical, in short, ideological forms in which men become conscious of the conflict and fight it out. So on a narrower, more specific scale, and one that people recognise very quickly when they've been around socialist alternative for a while, the contradictions of capitalism provoke struggles, and then in the struggles, people's ideas develop and can develop quite rapidly. But it's not just that objective circumstances mechanically drive the change in consciousness. People enter into the activity with pre-existing ideas, and they make conscious choices in those struggles. And these may affect how they act and whether their struggle wins victories or is badly defeated. And then the outcomes again influence, how things continue to develop, because a defeat can breed demoralisation, cynicism and passivity. Or it might in other circumstances. For example, if revolutionaries have intervened in the struggle, the defeat might lead to revolutionary conclusions. Victory, on the other hand, can encourage illusions in reformism because you win some reforms, it seems that the system could be reformed. Or it might build confidence and convince layers of workers that, well, really, we could change the world and it can drive the struggle forward. So material reality is the starting point, but ideas aren't somehow mechanically counterposed to this. And in fact, at times, the ideas that people have in their heads can change history because that influences what activity that they engage in. And in certain circumstances, Marx even argued, when an idea seizes the masses, it means it becomes a material force. And you see this occasionally, we saw it in some of the people's revolutions of the late 1980s in Stalinist Russia. When people took it into their heads that they were going to overthrow the system and they could, they would just protest and they wouldn't go home. And, we've seen these sort of what we call people's revolutions a number of times. Today, I think, you'd have to say that any analysis of the political situation we're in has to take account of the fact that it is part of the actual reality we're dealing with, that people think there's no alternative to just accepting what capitalism is doling out to us and that we can't win any struggle, so it's not worth bothering. And so John Rees sums up how this can be understood dialectically. He says, in practice, two things happen simultaneously. Thought becomes an objective force and material reality becomes subjectively manipulable. This is because practice contains both consciousness and materiality. And it's why Marxists are opposed to activity without conscious theory, because this just ends up bourgeois common sense dominates the struggle. But it's also why we're opposed to theory for the sake of theory, disconnected from activity and engagement in the struggle. This attitude has nothing to do with Marxism. And it's why Engels, George Lukács and others have always insisted that Marxism is the theory and practice of the struggle of the working class to establish a victorious workers' state. In other words, Marxism is the expression of the interests of the working class. Now, of course, this raises another question. Because how can you know if you're right just because you say you're a Marxist? Because patently the ideas of workers don't automatically express the ideas of Marxism. And so this, raises a question of theory and the divergence between the appearance of things and the actual reality. Because Marx argued in Capital that the general production of commodities for the market obscures the actual social relations of capitalism. And he refers to the lack of control people have over their lives as alienation. He says it seems that, social forces dominate us and the forces are out of control. And he uses the term commodity fetishism to talk about the fact that under capitalism, workers don't labour to provide the necessities of life the way they did under feudalism. And, that's the immediate example. They produce commodities, and these commodities are sold on the market. Workers don't know, often where they will end up, whether anyone will ever buy them, and they often can't buy them themselves or they wouldn't even want to, especially if they're producing nuclear weapons. And so the consequence is, Marx says in Capital, the specific social character of each producer's labour does not show itself except in the act of exchange. And therefore the mutual relations of the producers within which the social character of their labour affirms itself takes the form of a social relation between the products. Or to put it another way, a definite social relation between men, i.e., producing for each other for the needs of society, assumes in their eyes the fantastic form of a relation between things. And so experience in our society gives rise to misleading perceptions. It's difficult to see that exploitation takes place because labour power is a commodity on the market, and so it seems that we get a fair day's wage for a fair day's work rather than that whatever you're paid, you're being exploited. And it's difficult to see the common interest of all workers against all capitalists at times. And so that's why we need a scientific analysis to get to the underlying reality. And this reality, or content, as is often this reality or content, it's often thought in philosophy as simply negating the surface appearance of things or existing in complete opposition to it. But actually, there's a dialectical relationship between the two. And so seeing the way production and the market operate helps us to understand the surface phenomenon and why it is that people accept bourgeois interpretations of society. So, like, the market is real. It's not just an illusion. And it's a social institution that rises from the relations of production. And at the same time, its links with those relations is disguised. So to show how one produces the other and how they depend on each other, we need to explain the interconnections between two contradictory aspects of society. And now we begin to answer the question of how theory can be tested. If you remember what Marx said in the thesis on Feuerbach, the coincidence of the changing of circumstances and of human activity or self-change can be conceived and rationally understood only as revolutionary practice. Well, the experience of the working class struggle, both internationally and historically, opens the way to the truth. John Rees says, there is a point where the theory and the consciousness of the working class meet in practice. And the high points of the workers' struggles test the theory. Marx had said that the working class could liberate humanity and would have to smash the state after 1848. He concluded that. And then the Paris Commune, where beginnings of a workers' state, gave some flesh to this bones of the theory. Then the Soviets of 1905, when the workers showed what workers in a modern industrial society would, you know, the kinds of organisations they would develop, took the theory to a higher point because the workers demonstrated the basis for a workers' state. And so Rees says, theory and practice are independent moments, and so one can be the judge of the other, but ultimately they are parts of a single whole, moments of a single process called history. And this view of reality is contrary to the modern critics of Marxism, a guard against reductionism. It isn't reductionist because the various parts can't just be dissolved into each other, and neither can the totality be reduced to any of them. And so it's a guard against fatalism because, you know, there's no way that you can predict the outcome of things. And if you compare this with someone like Althusser, who is often thought to have developed a new Marxist theory in opposition to the reductionism of Marx, he conceived of history as a process without a subject, which treated humans as nothing more than bearers of or supports for social structures. And so Alex Kalinikos says, Althusser's reduction of agency to structure denied him the means to conceptualise struggle and change. And the post-structuralists then followed in Althusser's footsteps, and they too can't satisfactorily explain struggle and social change. And in particular, they can't offer a way forward for the struggle for a decent world. So I want to look at now at another concept, the negation of the negation, or the thesis, antithesis, in which all this is talking about is that two contradictory aspects of any situation and the conflict between them result in a synthesis, which is the result of that conflict. Now, if interpreted correctly, this recognises that there is no preordained outcome of this process of change, and neither is the synthesis just the eradication of one or other of the contradictions. But it's a new reality that emerges out of the conflict that's going on. And so, for instance, the first attempts at bourgeois revolutions were defeated. But eventually, you know, the one in England was successful, and then the French Revolution. And out of these bourgeois revolutions, capitalism wasn't born fresh and unique out of the ruins of feudalism. Actually, capitalism took over some of the pre-existing institutions, recreating them and remoulding them for their own ends. And two that we can immediately think of are the church and the family. Some other institutions were destroyed, such as the French monarchy, but in Britain, even the monarchy was integrated into the new capitalist state. And then if we look at the bourgeois revolutions in the later developing countries, there's a whole different process which raises a whole lot of new questions. And Trotsky's theory of combined and uneven development and permanent revolution is absolutely inconceivable without a dialectical method. And I would argue it's one of the great achievements of dialectics in the Marxist movement. I'm not going to go into all of that. I'm hoping most of you know something about those theories. So we can say that socialism will be born while elements of capitalism still thrive, and old ideas and institutions from capitalism will live on, and the oppressive structures of capitalism will only be overthrown as the worker state consolidates the new social relationships. And I think, you know, the many advances that have taken place under capitalism will lay the basis for socialism, such as international communications, so we can have a world forum to work out how to allocate resources and clean up the environment and all the rest of it. And I think this is a guard that, seeing that this is a process and that institutions that exist today won't just suddenly cease existing, is a guard against all kinds of utopian ideas of what can or should happen immediately after a revolution. Another example about this thesis and synthesis would be the contradiction between spontaneity and conscious organisation, which is a constant source of confusion, I think, on the left, or in philosophy generally. On the surface, these two phenomena appear to be in complete conflict. But organised groups of workers, or more, the more advanced workers, remain pretty irrelevant without some spontaneous element of workers' responses to their exploitation. But on the other hand, the spontaneous rebellion of masses of workers is very likely to come to a dead end or a terrible defeat without the intervention of class-conscious workers organised together. And so the resolution or thesis of this contradiction isn't that spontaneity is eliminated and all we need is some organisation that does everything, or that we need to rely on spontaneity and refuse to build a revolutionary organisation. The actual process is that the two aspects have to fuse so that there is a more profound struggle can develop than if either of these elements were missing. And so therefore, we would say, using the terms of the dialectic, a revolutionary party mediates the struggle and gives it a better chance of victory than it would otherwise have. And it's only really a dialectical view that can see the party in the way Leninists argue for it, that it is both part of and distinct from the mass of workers. And this is relevant to the issue of conscious intervention, because, again, only a dialectical view can see the role of individuals in history and understand it. To understand that no individual is the sole driver of history, but neither are individuals irrelevant. And there's a discussion by Trotsky of Lenin's role in the Russian Revolution, and he says that the revolution would have been defeated if Lenin hadn't got back to Russia when he did. And some people reject this as a great person of history or a great man of history theory. But we can say that Lenin was central to the building of the Bolshevik Party, but he was also made into the leader that he became by the process of building that party. So it's not about him just being some grand individual of history. He was formed by the growth and the development of the Bolsheviks and his role in trying to build it. And then his role could only be the critical role that it became when the social contradictions of Russia created the conditions in which the alternatives were posed: workers' power or reaction. So when the war broke out in 1914, Lenin couldn't determine the immediate direction of history, but what he did at that moment was linked to what happened in 1917 by standing firm against the war and trying to organise against it. And so here I want to make some comment about the social histories of Russia in 1917 to illustrate why a dialectical understanding of history can actually matter quite a lot. Because there's a whole body of social historians who recognised that workers were driven to revolutionary actions because of the material circumstances. They weren't just manipulated by the Bolshevik Party. But they didn't look at them in relationship to the other classes in Russia and to the struggle between those classes. So as one Marxist says, often the capitalists are at best a ghostly presence in their histories. And related to this weakness then, they didn't recognise the role of political ideas and of organisation in influencing the actual choices, conscious choices, that workers made. And so Mike Haynes, a British Marxist, says, there is a more or less clear separation between the social and political dynamics. These historians appeared to be saying that floating above the class struggle is this thing called Bolshevik politics, which may or may not have been influenced by the events of 1917, but which is essentially an autonomous force created by Lenin, Trotsky and others. And so, in the face of a right-wing assault in the 1980s and 90s, the social historians couldn't sustain their commitment to what had seemed like a very radical account of the Russian Revolution, and they couldn't refute the argument that the defeat of the revolution was the inevitable outcome flowing from the existence of the Bolshevik Party, and most of them recanted on their earlier histories. There's just a couple of extra points I want to make before I finish. There's another aspect of the dialectic called the law of quantity into quality, which relates to the understanding of the process of constant change. I'll just give a couple of examples, because some people, especially Stalinist accounts of the dialectic, use natural things like water boiling and then suddenly, you know, water becoming steam all of a sudden. But I think it's better to look at it in terms of social phenomenon. If you think about, well, today I think it's posed in Europe somewhat, you can see workers are in individual strikes all over the place, and it can create a real ferment in society. But if these strikes become joined together in a total general strike and a sense that the whole of the working class is organising together, there's a qualitative change between the impact of a general strike and the level of consciousness that that can develop and just all these individual strikes where there's not a lot of interconnection between them. And so there can be a whole process of development, and where the point of qualitative change between the individual strikes and the mass strikes comes, well, you know, it's a matter of analysis to decide when that happens. But if you look at the two extremes, at the beginnings of the strike wave, and then if it ends in, you know, mass general strike and class-conscious workers, you can see the qualitative difference. And this is associated with, you know, the transition from just mass struggle of people fighting for their rights to, at some point, it becoming a revolutionary struggle. And you can read about some revolutions where this qualitative change can happen within, you know, hours. If anyone's read Chris Harman's account of the Hungarian Revolution in 1956, that you had a mass outpouring of protest and people in the street only protesting and arguing for some democratic rights. And because some police opened fire on a section of the crowd, within hours, it had turned into a workers' revolution. There were workers on strike, people were running around organising committees, taking up arms, and we saw the beginnings, you know, a real genuine workers' revolution in the making. Other times, it can be a slower transition. We saw in Russia, you know, we see from the women's intervention on International Women's Day in February transforms the situation somewhat, but then all through 1917, workers have to develop their conscious understanding of what's happening, and a series of experiences transform their understanding from thinking that some provisional government might solve all the problems for them to an understanding that we have to take power through the Soviets, and understanding that the Bolsheviks is the only party that stands for that. Where you pinpoint how that consciousness is finally being changed is, again, one of analysis, but nevertheless, it's a qualitative change from February to October. On the other hand, we can see it in periods of defeat. If we go from the period of the 1970s, of mass upheavals in Australia, mass strikes, you know, mass radicalisation at one level in 1975 with the sacking of the Labor government and a huge industrial upsurge of workers demanding better pay and conditions. But step by step, a number of retreats, of defeats, of union officials convincing people to make compromises into the 80s, that we see significant changes in class consciousness. And at some point, we, you know, through analysis, you can find, and there's arguments about whether the actual downturn of industrial struggle and political confidence occurs in the early 80s or the late 70s. But if you contrast the atmosphere of 1975 with the atmosphere of 2010, we can see there's been, you know, a qualitative shift. There is one aspect of the dialectic that John Rees doesn't deal with, and I just want to say a little bit about it. It's what Lennon called seizing the key link. Because, and I think it's of some significance, because it's related to how you use the dialectic and seeing that the dialectic isn't just some abstract law into which facts could and should be squeezed. Because the dialectical is a material reality, but that reality can be only understood by abstraction and theory. And this means detailed analysis, examination of the facts and social relationships. And so being committed to the dialectic is no guarantee of actually finding the truth. And that's why Lennon insisted that truth is concrete, and it's why the argument of Rees that experience and practice, theory and practice have to come together sometimes to actually judge your theory. And Marx's method was to rise from the abstract to the concrete. So in Capital, he starts with the abstraction, the commodity. And through the law of value and a detailed examination of the economic structure of the system to the history and the development of capitalism. And it becomes more and more a concrete account of capitalism as you read Capital. And in the analysis, it's necessary to find out what is more fundamental than others. What are the contradictions driving social change? So Marx could have started with any number of things about capitalism, the market or individualism, but he pinpointed that the commodity summed up the key, like, underlying reality of the production of commodities was the key to understanding how society works under capitalism. And, you know, he seized on what came to be, what helped him to understand that society, so he was proven right. But then in analysing any situation that you were involved in, and trying to work out what is the next thing that needs to be done to take the struggle forward, understanding that all elements that are bombarding us, what we're experiencing, everything isn't of equal value. And so Lennon was an expert at seizing the key link of understanding what is the most fundamental thing. And so in 1903 in Russia, it was to establish a serious national organisation to prepare for the coming revolution. He said, we're in a period of wars and revolution. In October 1917, the time for revolution, he knew, could not last indefinitely, that the Bolsheviks had to seize the moment before the revolutionary enthusiasm of the working class ebbed away. And he was proven right when you compare what happened in Germany in 1923, when revolutionaries failed to seize the key moment, and the revolutionary forces were dissipated and led to catastrophic defeats, and actually laid the basis for fascism, the defeat of the German Revolution and the defeat of the Russian Revolution. And so today, the key link, I would argue, is to establish a core of revolutionaries, not to imagine that some small, inexperienced group of activists can lead significant mass struggles. So to finish, I'm just going to give you a bit of a taste of how some of the great Marxist thinkers have expressed some of these ideas, because basically I've been trying to summarise Rees in my own words. So Trotsky says, on how the dialectic relates to bourgeois science, dialectical materialism can be applied to new spheres of knowledge only by mastering them from within. The purging of bourgeois science presupposes a mastery of bourgeois science. You will get nowhere with sweeping criticism or bald commands. Learning and application here go hand in hand with critical reworking. Labriola, on human activity and history, says, man has made his history not by a metaphorical evolution, nor with a view of walking on a line of preconceived progress. He has made it by creating his own conditions, by developing successively his technical aptitudes, and by accumulating and transforming the products of his activity and this new environment. And this is the explanation of the process which is being accomplished among us and about us, and which has its whole existence in the objective relations of social life, of which we are the subject and the object, the cause and the effect. And George Lukács says that the proletariat is both the subject and the object of history. They're both exploited and the object of capitalist relations, but they are the subject of history. They can make the revolution and transform the world. But I think it's fitting to give the last word to someone whose scientific work, specialising in biology, is dedicated to fighting for human freedom, because after all, the point of Marxism is to understand the world in order precisely for that goal. I'm talking about Richard Levins, who received the Edinburgh Medal for Science in 1996, and it was said of him that he received the medal for his work on the integration of diverse sciences to create holistic models of population biology and ecosystems in practical cooperation with farmers, and his lifelong commitment to science for the people. And in his address on receiving this reward, Levins gave what I think is quite a succinct summing up of the materialist dialectic, which is really in some ways as good a summary of the dialectical method as you can find. And so I'll finish with his words. He said, "The most comprehensive self-conscious alternative to the predominant reductionism of Cartesian science, dialectical materialism, has been the starting point for my own research. It offers the necessary emphasis on complexity, context, historicity, the interpenetration of seemingly mutually exclusive categories, the relative autonomy and mutual determination of different levels of existence, and the contradictory, self-negating aspects of change." So I'll see you there.